Abbas couldn't understand what the three men gathered around him were saying. Their raised voices overtook even the clamor of the docks, the clatter of cartwheels on cobbles and braying donkeys and shattering storage jars. Abbas was 7 years old, and every word he could hear being spoken was foreign to him. He only knew the tongue his parents spoke, at home in their village outside Ctesiphon, which was many months' walk away from here. Wherever here was, whatever language these Romans spoke, he didn't know it. The big men in their faded, patched red cloaks towered over him. They shouted and gestured, sometimes at him and sometimes at each other. Abbas was sure that they would start fighting, maybe even pull out the wickedly sharp swords and daggers hanging from their belts. The events of the past several months had shown him precisely what those weapons did to a person, beginning with the shopkeeper who lived next door to him and his parents. The old man limped badly on a twisted leg, and the Roman soldiers had cut his throat from ear to ear. The blood that jetted from that deep, wide gash still visited Abbas in his nightmares, even though he had seen far worse since the day the soldiers seized him, razed his home, and dragged him away with the rest of the wailing captives. He hadn't seen his father die. That had happened inside the house, with Abbas standing captive just outside. But he now knew that nobody who made a noise like that survived. The boy remembered calling out for his mother over and over again, but she never appeared. He had no idea what happened to her. His last glimpse of her had been at the hands of a giant Roman, who dragged her away by the hair before disappearing down the street and led away from their house. Abbas hoped she was alive and prayed to the gods that she was safe. He tried to hold on to his memories of her. The freshly picked scent of ripe dates on her hands after a day in the orchard. The crinkles around her eyes when she smiled at him. The sing-song way she called out to him to stop playing and come inside the house. But those details were fading day by day, and they seemed to slip away further and faster the harder he clung to them. One of the three soldiers on the docks held Abbas by the upper arm with a grip stronger than any vice. Another, smaller man with rotten teeth and sunken eyes, scribbled on a sheet of papyrus. When that man was done writing, he rolled up the scroll, placed it in a leather case, and handed it to the soldier currently cutting off the circulation in Abbas's arm. Through a scraggly beard and chapped lips, the man with bad teeth spat a single word, the first one Abbas understood. Come. Against the unstoppable force of the soldier hauling him away down the dock toward the waiting ship, Abbas had no say. I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. For every year of the Roman Empire's existence, there were hundreds of thousands of people who were bought and sold in its slave markets. For some, it was a new experience, taken from seaside villages and lightning raids, snatched while drawing water from a remote well, or, most often, captured by the iron fist of the Roman war machine. Their first exposure to Roman society was being poked, prodded, and stripped naked on the auction block. For others, the slave market was a more familiar place. They might experience the degradation of being sold more than once, their owners tiring of them or turning them into ready cash. Slaves were fungible assets, chattel, and the slave market was where Romans most fully embraced not only the practice, but the principle of people as property. And yet, for all this, we still know surprisingly little about Roman slave markets and even less about slave traders. Considering the fact that perhaps 20% of the empire's population was enslaved, a proportion that rose much higher in larger cities, of which there were many, millions of people spent time in slave pens at some point in their lives, and often more than once. Millions of others were sold on port quays, at tabernas over cups of wine, or by the side of one of Rome's many impressive roads. In today's episode, we're going to focus on this little-discussed and historically elusive industry, one that was absolutely central to the functioning of the Roman economy. But of far more importance was the enslaved person's experience of this system. Being sold was a defining moment in a person's life. It marked a transition, a change in circumstances, a fork in the road, with one of the new paths potentially leading to a better life, maybe even freedom. The other new path, however, might lead them into the clutches of a vicious master and a brutal death sentence. Enslaved people had agency, even at this most precarious moment. Despite being treated as objects, tools that happened to speak, they found ways to shape the conditions of their enslavement by showing off their skills to particular prospective buyers and staying silent with others, by forming relationships with others being sold at the market, and by outright refusing to be sold to some masters and instead imploring others to take them. The slave market was an active arena for many competing desires and needs. Those of the prospective buyers who wanted to pay as little as possible and avoid being cheated, the sellers who were seeking the highest possible price for their wares, and not least, the people reduced to merchandise who were keenly aware of what was being said and done around them. Those that could did everything in their power to craft a version of themselves that would lead to a sale of their choosing. But even the best performers weren't always successful. Little Abbas, or Eutyches, the Greek name by which he was also known, will be our guiding light as we try to understand this horrible world. By following his path, or at least the possible pasts, presents, and futures he represents, we can begin to draw a clear picture of the systems of capture, sale, transportation, and resale that was the life of every enslaved person in the Roman Empire. Let's start with the broad outlines of the Roman slave trade. What we know, what we don't, and what's possible to understand with the evidence at our disposal. We don't have the kind of comprehensive data that scholars have painstakingly pieced together about the Atlantic slave trade of the 17th to 19th centuries. That level of detailed information allows us to put forth precise estimates for the numbers of people taken captive in Africa, where along the coast they were sold from, which ships transported them, how many people died along the way, which ports they arrived at, and how all those patterns changed from year to year, decade to decade, and century to century. The estimates you've probably seen for the African slave trade, roughly 12 million people in total between the early 1500s and the last known voyage in 1873, are the result of decades of intense, dedicated research. The archives of Liverpool trading firms and Portuguese colonial administrators, Caribbean tax collectors' records, Rhode Island merchants' account books. Put together, these collections give us enough data to work with that we can grasp the horrific scope of the whole while also allowing us to micro-focus on individual times, places, and contexts as needed. Other historical examples of slave trading, such as the centuries-long traffic from Africa and the Black Sea to the Islamic world and the Mediterranean, aren't as thoroughly documented, but there are still many detailed archives available to historians. There are no such archives for the Roman Empire. No tax offices teeming with records of sales or ships' manifests, no colonial-era censuses of enslaved people, no slave traders' account books. What we have are scattered references and written sources, like histories, letters, and poems. Inscriptions, probably our richest body of evidence that reference enslaved people, those who bought and sold them, and occasionally the experiences of the enslaved. And rare original documents, especially papyri, reed paper, that records sales. This isn't enough to draw a portrait of the entire Roman slave trade, of course. We have no idea of the total number of people who were sold into the Roman Empire's slavery machine, much less those sold in a given year. The evidence can't tell us precisely where they came from, which ports served as entrepôts, or where they went. We can't reconstruct the demographics of the trade to figure out how slave traders categorized people as merchandise, or estimate what percentage of people sold had been born into slavery as opposed to being abducted into the life. For all the richness of the Roman Empire's historical record, the kinds of sources we would need to do that work just don't exist. With the sources and information we do have, we can identify some broad historical patterns. The first is the importance of Roman military campaigning as a source of bodies for the slave trade. The ancient world did not distinguish between war for politics and war for profit. They were one and the same, and every army sought to strip as much wealth from enemy territory as humanly possible. In the earliest years of the Roman Republic, what our sources call military campaigns were really highly organized and systematized cattle raids executed at scale. As Rome grew, so too did its campaigns and their spoils. Portable wealth was preferable, so gold, silver, jewelry, and art were always on the menu. But livestock, whether animal or human, could transport themselves, which meant that they were useful for an army on the march and could be easily sold upon reaching a market. While planning my next book project, I did some back-of-the-envelope math for the major Roman military campaigns during the first half of the 2nd century BC, around Terence's time. Some deeply knowledgeable scholars checked my numbers and told me that I'm in the right ballpark. If I am, then the profits from the sales of those tens of thousands of people seized on those campaigns were even greater than the eye-wateringly large cash indemnities of tens of thousands of silver talents that Rome's defeated enemies had to pay. Slavery was big business, perhaps the biggest business in the ancient world. The incredible growth of the Roman economy in the Middle Republic was the bulbous root of all future Roman imperial prosperity, planted in the profits made from the buying and selling of enslaved people, the intensive and destructive abuse of their forced labor, and the eventual integration of freed slaves and their descendants into the citizen body of Rome. For many years, probably up to Caesar's conquest of Gaul in the 50s BC, foreign wars provided the vast bulk of Rome's supply of slaves. But they weren't the only source. We know that vernae, or children born to enslaved mothers and raised in their master's household, came to make up a greater proportion of the enslaved over time. Abandoned children, an unfortunately common sight in the ancient world, were fair game for slave traders. Pirates and brigands routinely snatched individuals and entire groups of people at sea, whom they then sold into slavery at entrepôts that didn't ask too many questions. This was how the Cilician pirates Pompey Magnus boasted of defeating near the end of the Republic became rich and powerful enough to warrant his attention. The church father Augustine wrote about highly organized gangs of people snatchers with elite political connections, operating 500 years later in his native North Africa, one of the core provinces of the Roman Empire. On the edges of the Roman world, warfare beyond the frontiers produced captives who could then be sold in exchange for coin, wine, fine pottery, and other highly valued luxury goods. A second major conclusion we can draw is that most purchases and sales of slaves weren't made by professional slave traders of the type who dominated the industry in the pre-Civil War American South. In fact, we can only identify around 10 individuals in the entire historical record of the Roman Empire who were explicitly identified as slave traders. Part of that lack is due to social stigma. Everyone knew that slave trading was unpleasant. They knew it in 19th century New Orleans, and they knew it in ancient Rome. But we know for a fact that there was an entire industry based around the slave trade, particularly at major ports of the Roman world, which acted as conduits for all types of economic activity, the slave trade included. All of these ports had a statarium, a platform for slave auctions, either permanent or temporary, along with pens or barracks for those awaiting sale. The people who made their living in it spoke euphemistically about their work. They happened to do business around the statarium. Others were workers around the statarium. Some were brokers of bodies, but rarely were they known outright as slave traders. The other, and probably more mundane reason we don't see more explicit references to slave traders, is that most sales weren't carried out by specialists. Merchants dealt in an array of different commodities, and slaves were just one of the things they bought, sold, and transported. They were a commodity like any other, unworthy of being singled out. Nobody needed to say explicitly that they dealt in slaves because everyone, given the opportunity, dealt in them. Some traders with nasty reputations had the good fortune of having friends in very high places. We know from Roman sources that Gaius Sallustius Crispus Passienus, consul for the second time in the year 44 AD, was one of the richest men in Rome. But thanks to an inscription in the Greek city of Ephesus, we know that he was also the patron, a highly placed advocate, of a group calling themselves Qui in Statario Negotiantur, those who do business on the slave auction platform. It's not hard to connect the dots and conclude that Passienus's enormous wealth, which helped make him one of the most prominent Romans of his day, came at least in part from his close ties to the slave trade. The future emperor Vespasian was even more directly involved, engaging with the trade while he was proconsul of Africa in order to restore his credit after he ran out of money. This earned Vespasian some derision from the senatorial class of Rome. They called him a mule driver, but the money spent just the same. By the time Abbas was sold in 166 AD, Roman captives could come from any number of places and experience an almost infinite variety of paths into slavery. But Abbas took the oldest, bleakest, and most common road. He was snatched up by the Roman military machine in the midst of a war, like so many millions before and after him. Only one document tells us that Abbas, or Eutyches, existed, a papyrus contract recording his sale on May 24, 166 AD, at the city of Seleukia Pieria in what is today southeast Turkey, for the price of 200 denarii. The papyrus, however, was found not in Seleukia Pieria, but in Egypt's Fayum oasis, what was then called the Arsinoite Nome. This detail tells its own story about what happened to this little boy after he was sold, and we'll come back to it later. But first, we need to try and understand how Abbas ended up at Seleukia Pieria and what he might have experienced in his 7 years of life. The Roman Empire was at its peak in the middle of the 2nd century. Marcus Aurelius ruled with a co-emperor, Lucius Verus, and together the two fought ceaselessly on Rome's frontiers, Marcus Aurelius along the Danube and Verus in the east. Rome's eastern neighbor was the powerful Parthian Empire, which extended all the way from the fringes of the steppe in Central Asia to the fertile lowlands of Mesopotamia. For over 200 years, the two empires fought on a regular basis, though the decades preceding Abbas's capture had been peaceful. Trajan extended Roman rule through Mesopotamia as far as the Persian Gulf, taking the Parthian capital of Ctesiphon in 116 AD, before returning it as part of the peace settlement. In 161 AD, the Parthians made a move into the vital border region of Armenia, replacing the Roman client king with a member of the Parthian ruling dynasty. The Parthians initially had the upper hand in the subsequent war, but by 165 AD, Lucius Verus pushed deep into Parthian territory in Mesopotamia. This is where Abbas's story begins. Let's review the precise wording of Abbas's bill of sale. It was drawn up at Seleucia Pieria on May 24, 166 AD. It also reads, quote, Gaius Fabulius Macer, subaltern of the trireme Tigris of the Praetorian fleet of Misenum, purchased from Quintus Julius Priscus, soldier of the same trireme in the same fleet, a boy of Trans-Euphrates origin named Abbas, also known as Eutyches or by whatever other name he is called, about 7 years old at a price of 200 denarii and the customs duty per head. Fabulius Macer demanded the formal acknowledgement in accordance with the edict that the boy was in good health. Now, this gives us a great deal of information to work with. The date, the phrase Trans-Euphrates origin, and the identifiers were given for the buyer and seller tell us that Abbas was captured during Lucius Verus's Parthian campaign, which drove down the major rivers of Mesopotamia toward the Parthian capital of Ctesiphon. The Roman armies crushed the Parthians near the city of Dura Europos and went on to loot, burn, and butcher their way south. Ctesiphon was located near present-day Baghdad along the Tigris River, with its twin city, Seleucia, located on the other side. Lucius Verus's armies sacked both Ctesiphon and Seleucia in 165 AD, destroying the Parthian royal palace and putting Seleucia to the torch. Somewhere, amid all that violence, a Roman soldier snatched a little boy and shattered everything he'd ever known. That little boy's name was Abbas, or Eutyches. Abbas is a Semitic name, while Eutyches is Greek. The area around Ctesiphon was extremely ethnically diverse, with Greeks, Parthians, Aramaeans, Assyrians, and many others living in close proximity. The dominant languages were Assyrian and varieties of Aramaic, Semitic languages, and Greek, with Parthian serving only as the tongue of the ruling elite. Despite living under the yoke of Parthian kings, Abbas never would have spoken their language and may never even have heard a word of it. Many people born in this region had two names, one Semitic and one Greek, and that would fit little Abbas's profile. His captors, of course, may have given him a Greek name that was easier for them to pronounce, a common practice and a means of dehumanization. We know nothing of Abbas's parents. If Roman soldiers took him and his parents together, they were certainly separated by the time he reached Seleucia Pieria on the coast. Roman slave traders had no compunctions whatsoever about taking an enslaved child away from his parents, and children even younger than Abbas appear on their own in other sale contracts. While he ended up in Egypt, his parents may well have been dispersed across the Roman world, cooking and doing laundry at a frontier garrison like Dura Europos on the Euphrates, laboring in a workshop in Antioch, or toiling in a quarry in the Aegean. It's just as likely, however, that their lives ended in the orgy of violence that accompanied the fall of cities like Ctesiphon and Seleucia. As we saw with Nanaia Elai 800 years earlier, the clinical terms we see in the record, sack, devastation, razing, conceal mass murder, wanton destruction, widespread sexual violence, and horrors our 21st century minds can barely comprehend. We can't know the specifics of Abbas's capture or the fate of his parents, but it's possible they survived the Roman attack only for their son to be grabbed from a riverbank. He may have been accidentally left behind when they fled in the face of the advancing soldiers. Imagine them wondering forevermore what had become of their little Abbas, with no way of knowing his fate, much less finding him and bringing him home. Both the buyer and the seller listed in the sale document from Seleucia Pieria were members of the Roman military, sailors of the fleet stationed at Misenum in southern Italy, who had been detailed to this far side of the Mediterranean in preparation for the massive campaign against Parthia. It's logical to assume that members of the fleet would have been put to work along the major rivers of Mesopotamia, mostly supporting the army logistically as it moved overland. If that's the case, then the seller, Quintus Julius Priscus, a common sailor, may have acquired Abbas personally, snatching him out of the ruins of Seleucia or a nameless village en route. It's also possible Priscus never ventured onto the Euphrates at all and bought a boss from a soldier or one of the merchants who traveled with the army and facilitated these kinds of transactions. We can't say either way, but my guess is that Priscus wasn't the original captor. Rather, he served as one of many middlemen in the transactional chain that brought a boss from the vicinity of Ctesiphon to Egypt. What isn't a guess is that by the time he was sold at Seleucia Pieria, Abbas had already endured far more than any person, and especially any child, should ever have experienced. Imagine the little boy's terror as he watched his home burn, only to then be caught in the iron grip of a towering Roman soldier and dragged away, unable to comprehend words being shouted at him in languages he didn't understand, calling out for his parents and receiving no answer. He wasn't alone. There were other captives with him, herded into makeshift pens and kept under guard. Perhaps some kind person embraced him and helped keep him warm on the cold desert nights, soothing him when his grief and fear overwhelmed him. We don't know much about what happened in Roman slave pens, but we know kindness and empathy existed in even the worst places associated with the Atlantic slave trade centuries later. One of the most important lessons history teaches us is just how consistent our human behaviors are, cruelty and kindness alike. We can hope a surrogate parent stepped up for little Abbas in his time of need, as so many did in the holds of slave ships or the rancid barracks of trading forts along the African coast. These places were also full of their own horrors. Sexual violence and sickness and hunger and captives tearing each other apart over scraps of food while their captors looked on, unmoved. This was the plight shared by every enslaved person, regardless of time period or country of origin. As much as we might hope he found a friend, it's entirely possible that Abbas faced his journey alone, stewing in a mire of trauma that would break down even the strongest among us. But somehow, against all odds, Abbas survived all of that. We know he made it to Seleucia Pieria, because that's where he was sold to Gaius Fabulius Macer, who held a position equivalent to that of a non-commissioned officer in the same Roman fleet based at Misenum. Macer presumably saw Abbas as a viable, low-risk investment. 200 denarii was a bargain, and we can surmise that the statarium, the auction platform, was a lively place with so many captives for sale. Abbas may not have had that particular experience. The document is proof of ownership for a private transaction on which customs duties had to be paid. It was an essential thing to have if Macer intended to sell Abbas, which he obviously did. Macer wasn't a slave trader by profession. He was a sailor. But we can see him here doing business on the side, using his pay or plunder from the campaign to invest in an asset that he hoped to sell for a profit away from Syria's glutted markets. In this, Macer was actually the prototypical Roman slave trader, someone who saw the potential margins on an investment without particularly caring who or what that investment was. The specialized slave traders who gathered around the statarium were the exceptions, not the rule, in the Roman trafficking of human bodies. From Seleucia Pieria, we know Abbas eventually traveled south to Egypt, probably passing through the great port city of Alexandria on his way down the Nile to the Fayum Oasis. We don't know how he got there. A merchant may have purchased Abbas from Macer in Seleucia Pieria and transported him, but I doubt that. It's more likely to me that on its way back to Italy from Syria, Macer's ship stopped in Alexandria, and that's where he sold Abbas to a local buyer. Perhaps that buyer was to be Abbas's long-term owner, but it was probably a local merchant who then took the boy downriver to the place where his contract was found nearly 2,000 years later. This is where Abbas's story ends, at least what we know of it based on the scant evidence we have. We can hope that he lived a long, healthy, and joyful life, surrounded by a new family that he built hundreds of miles away from the Mesopotamia of his birth, that he was eventually freed and subsumed into mainstream society in Roman Egypt. Even in that optimistic scenario, however, the chances of Abbas returning to his original home were slim. His previous life, like that of so many millions of others taken by the Romans, was over. What Abbas's story makes clear is that the movement from life as a free person to life as a slave wasn't a one-step process. It involved a long, harrowing journey rife with humanity's worst. From the terrifying moment of capture to repeated sales in which the captive's fate hinged on the subjective intentions and character of the buyer, every step of a person's journey from freedom to enslavement was agonizing and uncertain. Some were lucky, relatively speaking, and found influence over those who bought them and what happened to them next. But that probably wasn't the case for a 7-year-old boy like Abbas, a child who lacked marketable skills. He was a captive, his agency stripped away. When ancient sources list the vast quantities of captives taken on a campaign, the glittering spoils of war, and the gifts that victorious emperors lavished on their soldiers and supporters. Underneath all of that information are countless and uncounted stories, just like that of Abbas. He, more than piles of silver coin or bits of golden plunder, was the prize that empires were built to claim over and over again. Next time on Past Lives, we'll turn towards the west, to the opposite end of the Roman Empire, Britain, where a young man named Patricius was taken and sold into slavery across the Irish Sea. He escaped, but returned years later to bring the Christian faith to Ireland. We know him as St. Patrick. Thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori.
Until next time,
this has been Past Lives.